Thanks again, Brent. What wonderful singing. What a fine congregation. I'm so thankful that we can have a few hours together, and I'm getting to know some of you. And I know you have been out exercising, and once you sit down in about 10 minutes, it will be a challenge to stay awake. And I want to tell you, I have gone back to my room, and I have worked through my talk, and I put myself to sleep reading it. So if you need to get some rest, I will not be offended. And this is a little bit more of a lecture than preaching, but I want to begin in the book of Acts and read you two verses from Acts. First from chapter 4, verse 19, and then from chapter 5, verse 29. And I hope that I can pull these threads together. The theme for our weekend has been how God works the same in all ages. And we've been seeing the chief tools that the early church used, the first of which was to wait on the Holy Spirit. The second of those tools was to hold fast to the preaching, the proclamation of God's Word. And then in our second session, we looked at those four principal activities of the church. And in our two sessions tomorrow, I'm gonna continue to go through some themes of the book of Acts. So again, this is a flyover. This is to take a 30,000 foot view and to look at some of the big themes of the book of Acts that hopefully you can apply in your life. And one of those, and again, church growth experts would probably be surprised or very upset to find that one of the means of the growth of church was when the church in the first century acted courageously as they dealt with both ecclesiastical authorities and then with civil magistrates. And there's much in our country when we get to the end of this and in the West that we've gained from this. But listen to these two verses to set your mind. In Acts chapter 4, beginning, go back to verse 18. The context is that the healing I referred to earlier of the crippled beggar earlier, when he was healed, Peter and John were hauled before the ecclesiastical leaders, the church leaders, the Sanhedrin, if you will. And they were asked to give an account of why they did what they did. And as Peter begins to preach, he opens up the scriptures, and the net result is seen in verse 18. In Acts 4:17, the leaders wanted to just squelch the Christian movement. Verse 18 reads, "Then they called them in again and commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John replied, 'Judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God. For we cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard.'" And if I can note for you, just to review and put this in its context, what they had seen and heard was the life and ministry of Jesus, and particularly His resurrection, which was not a comfortable topic for the Jews to hear about over and over again. And it seemed that Jesus and His followers kept poking their finger in the eyes of all of the Israelite leaders when He kept saying, "And you know He's not dead, and you know He's not really gone, and this isn't over, He's risen." And so they were ordered by the churchly authorities not to preach that anymore. And you see Peter's answer, which really is the basis of my talk, but see it repeated, if you will, in the next chapter, in chapter 5, and another occasion when they are charged to stop preaching. Let's read Acts 5:27 through 29. "Having brought the apostles, they made them appear before the Sanhedrin to be questioned by the high priest. 'We gave you strict orders not to teach in this name.' And he said, 'Yet you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and determined to make us guilty of this man's blood.' Peter and the other apostles replied, We must obey God rather than men. And that's the hallmark of the early apostolic views on church and state. And I think it still has much for us to learn today. Now, I want to take that first century case study of boldness and jet forward a millennium and a half. For 1,500 years, the Christian church continued to live, dwell, thrive, and be persecuted at the same time. Just before the Protestant Reformation, which many people will celebrate tomorrow, there was an outstanding Christian leader, actually an early Protestant, named William Tyndall. And in 1521, William Tyndall wrote this one sentence that summarized the view of Christendom about the relationship between church and state authorities prior to Martin Luther's rise. Of course, he posted the thesis in 1517, but that was a movement just beginning. But in 1521, Calvin had not yet been converted. Most of the other Protestant reformers had not been converted. 1521, William Tyndall wrote, "Government, per se, is divinely ordained by God in scriptures. Bad rulers were sent by God to chastise the nation for their sins. Rebellion causes more harm to innocents than to the guilty." And Tyndall went on, and I'll read you another quote from his works later in this talk. Tyndall went on to teach that Christian citizens were obligated to obey the civil government, the monarch, the king in this case, no matter what happened, and that there was a teaching of unqualified submission which was called for. Only a generation later, things changed rapidly. By 1564, one of Calvin's disciples, John Knox, and others were actually teaching and publishing biblical justifications for rebelling against the ungodly rulers, but they could only do that as they were protected in the safe haven of Geneva. And so in between 1521 and 1564, you have this sea change, and I want to try to fill in some of those gaps for you in this talk today and try to fill in some of our Protestant great-great-great-great-grandfathers. If Brent can trace his lineage back to Charles Wesley. You said Charles. He'd be happy you're singing his hymns. They don't even sing those probably in the Methodist Church much these days. So we do sing some Charles Wesley hymns. We need to know that our great-great-great-great-grandparents further back, Calvin and Knox, and some of the other disciples that you don't know too well of John Calvin were actually very important in forming the political landscape of the West. When you come to the American colonies in 1750, a well-known American colonial pastor named Jonathan Mayhew preached a famous sermon, which was the sea change, and most historians date it to 1750, when he preached in a New England pulpit that unlimited submission was not what God had called for. So that's a big change. How did that change happen? How did that sea change come about? And the change was much closer to Tyndall's time in the 1500s than it was to Mayhew's time in the 1750s. So I'm going to give you some summary statements. Again, these are our quotes. This can be a little tedious, so if your mind wanders, draw pictures or something. Now, I want to break down, as I've classified and seen these, there are three arguments, there are three strands of argument in the Protestant political theory, in the tracts that were written by Calvin and his disciples on how we relate to the civil magistrate. And one argument we might call the ontological argument is basing the action that we take on the return to political conditions of God's intended created order. So you don't have to know the word ontological. It's a big word. By the way, my wife, who was I talking to? Somebody here was Catholic. Mark's wife, yeah, in the back. And my wife is the best Bible student in our home. She's the best writer in our home, although she's never written a book. She's the most insightful person in our home. And at our conference last week, one of the guest speakers was talking about prolegomena, and all of our friends were laughing at my wife because she's 60 years old, been married to a pastor, a theologian for 35 years. She said, "I've never heard that word. I don't even know what that word means." You don't have to know what prolegomena means. You don't have to know what ontological means. But what I want you to know is that one of the arguments for how we interface with the state is that we want to return to the political conditions of God's intended order. A second argument for that is a hierarchical argument, and that is that certain priorities prevail if there's a conflict that arises. And thirdly, there is an argument in these Protestant forefathers from economy. We call that an economical argument. By that, they mean that there are certain organized spheres, family, church, and state, that work together. Now, some Christians, particularly following from the tradition of Abraham Kuyper, Cornelius Van Til, Francis Schaeffer, and others, say that they are people who are interested in the kingdom. They're one kingdom. I have other good friends who refer to themselves as two kingdom advocates. If you're not accustomed to that terminology, I want to give you a new term today. Here we go. I am a three kingdom advocate. And I'll bet you most of you are too, whether you know that or not. And by that, what we mean is that God has ordained three spheres of government. Not one, not two, but three. And they are the family at the lowest level, the church at the next level, and the state, the civil government. And in each of those, each of them have unique callings, unique charters. They are to work together and not to usurp the other's leadership. They're to respect the others. In fact, they cannot do what the other sphere of government is ordained to do if they wanted to. The family, for example, and this has been a big confusion in my lifetime, the family cannot do the work of the church. And we hear that and we go, well, wait a minute, Pastor, you're supposed to be building families. Families are important. I thought you were a big family advocate. Well, I certainly am. But the family can do certain things, but the family cannot offer the sacraments. The family cannot bring about church discipline. The family cannot lead in corporate worship, although they should be leading in family worship. Similarly, the church can't do things that the family is supposed to do, nor that what the state is supposed to do. Right? The church cannot give all of the discipline and moral training on a hands-on way for each of your set of children and grandchildren. You have to do that in your homes. The church simply cannot do that. We can support that, and we work very, very supportively with that. Neither is the church given the authority to use capital punishment. The church is not given the authority to execute people because of their sins, no matter how serious and notorious. So God has ordained the state to do certain things, the church to do certain things, and the family to do certain things. And that is the economical argument that you'll see in the pages of John Calvin and other Protestant Reformation writers. And they drew on a set of verses. There are actually about 12 or 14 verses that the Protestant Reformers came back to time and time again. Some are in the Old Testament, some are in the New Testament. And any theologian, any pastor worth his weight would preach or teach or write on those passages. Genesis chapter 9 is one. In the book of Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, we have the basis for capital punishment. That's not something that states have thought up. That's not something that states should even have the right to do or not to do, because it's divinely ordained. And after the flood, God told Noah that in the coming days, if anyone shed the blood of another human being, then his blood would have to be shed. That's capital punishment. Okay, now somebody has to do that. And you can say, okay, who is going to be the vindicator, who's going to exact justice? Well, it could be individuals, but you'll see throughout the Old Testament time and time again that God actually speaks against that with regularity, because there can be too much passion involved. And if we are bringing about justice, invariably, if you poke my eye out, I'm going to poke two of yours out. If you injured my leg, I'm going to injure both of yours. In my passion, and in my revenge. And that's actually why the law of retribution is given by God. Not to say you must gouge an eye out for an eye, but that when you do exact justice, and when there are penalties, that they not be excessive. There's actually mercy in the Old Testament law code. And in Genesis chapter 9, you see God's divine approval for capital punishment, and you have to say, okay, who's to carry that out? Over time, and this is one of Martin Luther's great contributions, over time, Protestants and some Catholics too said that God gave that assignment to the state, although the state was just in very small seed form in its day. He didn't give that authority to an individual or to a family or to the church, but that was a prediction that God wanted the states to handle that. So Genesis chapter 9 became a text that was preached on a lot for church and state matters. Another Old Testament text is 1 Samuel 8. Do you remember 1 Samuel 8? Anybody know that? It's a famous text. There were probably more American sermons in the 20 years leading up to the American Revolutionary War that were preached on that passage than any other single passage. In that, the prophet Samuel comes to his people. I'll summarize it. And the people say, we need a king. Why did they say we need a king? Because everybody else had one. This is political keeping up with the Joneses. Every other nation had a king. Israel thought, if we just have a king, then we'll have orderliness, we'll have unity, we'll have cohesion, we'll have efficiency. And Samuel said, oh, you need to think about this. There's a much better way. Keep God as your king. He's really fine. And don't have a human king. Because what is he going to do? Well, the human king, if you've read 1 Samuel 8 recently, the king, Samuel said, is going to conscript your sons and daughters. He's going to force them to serve in his military battles. He's going to take your crops. He's going to oppress you. And then in an argument that Samuel thought would surely cause the Israelites to back off, he said, and he's even going to take, hold your wallets, 10%. He's going to tithe. He's going to take a tithe of your money. Most Americans would love to get back to a mere 10% tax rate. In Samuel's time, and it gives you something about the relative tax rates, in Samuel's time, he thought that was a shocking, outrageous figure. That'd be like me telling you today, if you vote for somebody, he's going to have you pay $1 million in taxes every year. 1 Samuel 8 was preached on far and wide, and so were the book of Judges. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We had four great sermons from the life of Samson by Robert Godfrey last weekend in our conference. And there's a lot of material to draw from in the book of Judges. As I'll say in just a minute, it was one of the most frequently drawn upon set of texts to argue for rebellion against civil governors. Can any of you think? Let's have a few questions and answers, a little bit of audience participation wake you up. Can you name me a time in the book of Judges when there was rebellion against authority? All right, and I only want, if you're on the back three or four rows, to answer. No, you don't count. Back three or four rows only. Anything in Judges? Any kings end up being...
Ada.
You're too close. Remember Ehud? Eglon? Remember? He went into his chamber, he took his sword out, put it on his other leg so he could get through TSA security. They didn't even think to check that leg. He was a left-handed judge, and he went in, rammed his two-edged sword through the fat judge, then sunk in. He put him in a little water closet, went off, escaped. They discover the dead king 45, 50 minutes later, and the king's overthrown. Well, you can imagine that American Protestants would love that passage in about 1760 or 1770 when George III was excessively taxing and doing other things. Also in the Old Testament, the book of Daniel is drawn upon a good bit, in Daniel chapters 4 through 6. And the Ten Commandments themselves are drawn on to teach about the relationship of the believer to the civil magistrate. Now you might say, okay, how do the Ten Commandments teach on government? Well, there's that first one that says, don't have any other gods, only worship God. Okay, so the government's not to be God. But short of that, what did the Ten Commandments say? Well, and then there's that fifth one that says you're to honor your father and mother. And most Protestant theologians extend the principle beyond the home. You're not only to honor your mom and dad, but you're to honor your elders and your pastors in your church. And in the civil sphere, you're to honor the king if you have one, or whoever the leader is, or the judge, whoever the leader is of your nation, the governor. And so the fifth commandment does indeed bring commands for obedience to more than just your biological birth home. We are to give honor. Romans chapter 13 expands. We're to give honor to those to whom honor is due. We pay tribute to those to whom tribute is due. We pay taxes, in other words, to whom taxes is due. Taxes are due. So there are many Old Testament passages, but in the commandments, there's an argument. There's a consistent argument. You're a well-taught church, so I think I can do this quickly. But the commandments are broken down into two tables. The first four deal with our duty toward God. Have only one God. Don't create idol substitutes. Don't take His name in vain. Keep His day. Then from commandment number 5 through 10, those deal horizontally with our neighbors, with our fellow man. And it starts with the first relationship you have. Honor your father and mother and all authorities. Don't kill. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. Don't even covet. And so the tables of the commandment have a certain priority. And in a very clever argument, at least it seems to me, I wouldn't have thought of it by myself, John Calvin's disciple Theodore Beza, many of you won't know of Beza, but Beza was born in 1520, lived to 1605. He became Calvin's Timothy. If Calvin was Paul, he was his lieutenant. And Beza argued as well as any others. There were several others in this company, but as well as any others, Beza argued, okay, we have the two tables of the law, and if the governor, who is addressed in commandment number 5, the second table, if the governor forfeits his role and becomes a tyrant and asks you to violate the first four, those have a priority. God is, in other words, more important than other human beings. Simple concept. And Beza said the very structure of the law gives us footing on which we say we will have limited obedience to the civil magistrate. The same is true, by the way, for the church rulers and leaders. You're not called to unqualified absolute submission to your church leaders. You're called to follow them as long as they're biblical. And you're to follow them even when they make judgments that are not necessarily the ones you would make, because sometimes they know more than you do and they also have experience, and we're to be submissive people. But if your church leader, your elder or your pastor ever were to call on you to deny the deity of Christ or to deny the Trinity or to justify same-sex marriages and things that are clear violations of God's Word, then you would have to say, thank you, Pastor, thank you, Elder, but I can't go there. God's Word is my authority. You'd have to say, in essence, some version of those verses in Acts 4 and Acts 5 that I began this session with. You'd have to say, we have to honor God over man. And so when the Jerusalem authorities told the New Testament apostles, you can't preach and quit disturbing the peace and stop getting everybody all stirred up about this Jesus who we put in that tomb and we know He's gone, stop preaching because you're making our lives very difficult, the apostles, with Peter as their spokesman, and others said, we must obey God over man. We must obey the first table of the law. Have no other gods above God. And if you're going to command us to do something that is opposite of what God says, then we're not going to be able to follow that. Now, you're Presbyterians, so I say this advisedly, and I'm sure Calvin and the revolutionary American forefathers said this advisedly too. Because you're Presbyterians and because you're clever, if given just a little bit of time, you can make all kinds of arguments. You can argue about any position you want to. You're a smart group of people. And you can create arguments, and you can say that everything from the speed limits to taxation rates are a violation of the First Commandment. You're capable of doing that, but that's a little bit dishonest. Okay? I cannot say that I'm disobeying. When I drive home tomorrow, I can't drive the speed limit I wish to drive, and my freedom is severely inhibited when that happens because Georgia and Florida kick off at 3:30, and I'm not going to make that. And I can't go 120 miles an hour in order to get home and say, when I pulled over, officer, I'm a minister of the gospel, I've been preaching at a retreat for my friends in Kingsport, Tennessee, and my conscience is free. This 55-65 stuff binds my conscience. I can't follow that. I'm going to obey God first, not your speed limits. Okay, so be very, very careful with that. Be careful with your church leaders. Notwithstanding, though, there's a Protestant principle in the book of Acts that's articulated. I'll read you some of Calvin's comments on it in just a minute. But the principle is essentially this, that within these three spheres of government, in the family, in the church, and in the civil state, we are put in orders by God. He's designed us to be that way. He's not designed us to be individuals who just live alone. Neither are we just packs and herds, but we are to come socially into certain communities, beginning with the smallest, which is a family, and then a church, and then we ally ourselves in regional configurations in one way, shape, or form. And when we do those, God gives those a definite order. And in each of those, the leaders may transgress that order, just as you may transgress that order by breaking the law. Leaders have it within their abilities to grasp, to be clutching. The old word is to usurp, to try to take over more than they should. And when that happens, our colonial forefathers had the good common sense and biblical sentiments to say to King George III and others, "This far and no further." Where'd they get that? It's worth asking, because if you go back into a time travel machine to the year 1560, let me ask you to name the democracies in the world. 1560. Well, there's no America, right? Okay. Geneva was in 1560. Small little. It's a little pocket. Geneva was a city-state at the time. This isn't even part. This is pre-Switzerland. This isn't modern Switzerland. Geneva was seen as a little suburb of France. Where else? 1560. There's only one little tiny pocket. Venice. Merchant of Venice. Capitalism sprung up there and was growing, and that's a totally different story. But it is so much of an exception that it proves the rule. There was no place else. A few years later, you could have gone, in 1578, you could go to Holland. The Dutch Calvinists were the next group to have in fact, they had a Declaration of Independence about 1580. That was a pattern for the American one. Where did all of these democracies, all of our societies where people can vote, where there's amazing freedom compared to world history and even to our own time, they came about because a group of Protestants read the Bible. And they read Acts chapter 4 and they read Acts chapter 5 and they went back, and here's something they did courageously. They reinterpreted their tradition, the tradition that William Tyndale had articulated, and they took that 1,500 years of history, and just as the Protestants did with the doctrine of justification by faith alone, so they boldly reinterpreted the political doctrines of the church that were tied to various forms of monarchy. Where did they do this? In 1554, there was an early commentary on the book of Judges by one of Calvin's associates, Martin Bucer. You need to know that John Calvin wasn't the only reformer. Martin Luther certainly wasn't the only reformer. There were some before Luther, and there were some better ones after Luther in Lutheran circles. Many would say the same is true of Calvin. I don't know if you know, I wasn't planning on doing it, but I'll give you a short glimpse. If you know Calvin's testimony, Calvin was called to Geneva by a very fiery, the historians say, mercurial Frenchman who called Calvin to Geneva while he was wandering. And Guillaume Farel spotted a really talented young man. And Guillaume Farel did this thing that preachers are just horrible and prone to do. They'll go up to somebody and twist your arm and say, "Brother, don't you think you're called to the ministry or to the mission field? Or I think you're called to be an elder or a deacon." And Farrell did that to Calvin, and Calvin said, "Well, thank you, Pastor Farrell. I'm aware of your reputation, and it's a good one, and I'm very flattered But God has called me to a life of scholarship. And so I'm going to go back to the libraries, and I'm going to research, and I'm going to write books. And Brent could tell you, and several others, Jason Roddy and others, if you've ever been a pastor, it would be better to be a researcher in a library. It's a lot safer. Pharaoh said, "May God rain fire down on you if you do not accept this call." And he prayed that his conscience would bother him and trouble him. And finally, Calvin relented. And William Farrell would not have been the reformer to make a lasting impression. Today, we would probably, if you had a pulpit committee looking for pastors, you'd probably go, "William Farrell's a little bit hot-tempered. A little bit of a knucklehead. He's too hot to handle. Let's don't have him." And yet, he was a man. He was a bold man that God was raising up. And he was the forerunner to John Calvin. And in Geneva, Calvin was there beginning in 1536. I'm sorry, 1534. And when Calvin came to Geneva, Geneva had just recently, and you're exactly right in your history, Geneva had just voted to become an evangelical city-state, a Protestant city-state. And it was unparalleled at the time for that to happen. If you've ever been to Geneva, and some of you will go, no doubt, you'll see this wonderful cathedral that's several versions later than the one where Calvin was. But in the 1530s in Geneva, it was a Roman Catholic cloister. There was a monastery, there was a cathedral, there were schools, there were all kind of buildings. There were numerous capacities that the Roman Catholic Church owned, and the city-state of Geneva was a Roman Catholic city-state until they met one time in May, and they raised their hands, and they voted, and they said, "We want to be Protestant." They voted, and immediately all the keys were handed down. It was a bloodless revolution. It's really striking to see that happen. Now, of course, for the next 20 years, they'd still have to fight off the French Catholics who kept wanting to repossess what they saw as their territory. Well, Calvin attracted a number of different scholars. There were three or four cities where scholars were magnetically drawn to. Geneva was one of them. Strasbourg was another. And Zurich was another. And all of those are in what we think of as parts of Switzerland or France today. And in Strasbourg, there was another reformer named Martin Bucer. Don't confuse him with Martin Luther. It's easy to make that confusion. But Martin Bucer, as early as 1554, wrote a commentary on the book of Judges. I have a copy in my study. It's really something I value greatly. And in that copy, which was translated in English about 10 years after he wrote it, Bucer's commentary on Judges makes the points where the New Testament is read back into the Old, and where the Ehud Eglon adventure is interpreted in light of Acts 4. And there are several others. when the horrible king is on the run, and I forget his name, maybe Brent can help me. And when Deborah goes out to battle with Barak, and the king comes, what's his name that met Jael? He ran into the wrong girl. Sisera, thank you. And when Sisera's on the run, he comes to the tent of Jael, a nice little girl, could be like you, could be any wonderful little young lady, and she was taking care of the farm, taking care of things, had a tent. Sisera said, "Listen, I need a place to rest." She said, "Sure, come on in. And she said, "Would you like some water?" And you remember the story? He said, "You know, actually, I'd like some more milk." So he's kind of pushing the envelope a little bit on his hospitality. If I were on the run, I think I'd just say, "Could I just have some water and be quiet?" But he said, "Some warm milk." She said, "Sure, I'll bring you some warm milk." Some commentators think that had a certain anesthetizing effect, whether it did or not. Anyway, he was tired. He went to sleep. Here comes a girl, and with one stroke, she did not submit to the ruler. But she took a tent peg and a hammer. Wham! Clang! No more Sisera. That's not exactly submitting to your local ruler, is it? So as Protestants would begin to comment on these passages, they were given great fodder, and as they began to comment and write commentaries on it, guess who begins to get nervous? Monarchs. In fact, most of Calvin's followers were given a name. They were called Monarchomarchs. of those who would destroy and overthrow the kings. In Romans 13, John Calvin calls for submission to the rightful government, but not to an unlawful government. The powers from God, Calvin wrote, are appointed for the legitimate and just government of the world, for though tyrannies and unjust exercise the power, those are not ordained as government, yet the right of government is ordained by God. And he continues in his discussion, his commentary on Romans chapter 13, to discuss the limits of obedience to civil magistrates. Still, Calvin died 1564. Put that as a bookmark in your timeline. By 1564, Calvin himself was still encouraging most of his followers to be submissive to the king. Of course, put it in its context, both Calvin and Luther, toward the end of their lives, were able to live safely in city-states. Luther protected by the Duke, and Calvin in Geneva, a city-state, where they were able to be free and proclaim the gospel. So they weren't under the threat and harassment. Heinrich Bullinger, some of you know that name, is another of Calvin's friends. He was the successor to Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich. And Bullinger wrote a very well-known work in 1534 entitled The Testament on the Covenant of God, the One and Eternal Covenant. Now, Ulrich Zwingli, Calvin's compatriot in the north of Switzerland, was a very fiery pastor. He began to teach through the Gospel of Matthew at the historic Grossmünster Cathedral in Zurich. Some of you, if you've been to Zurich, can't miss it. And Bullinger, unfortunately, led a short life. He died when he was 27. Anybody remember why he died? What happened? He was leading his troops, and he died in the Battle of Kappel in Switzerland. So he was succeeded by Heinrich Bullinger, and Bullinger addressed the laws and began to expound the Ten Commandments. And when Bullinger expanded the Ten Commandments, he said this is the form of a covenant. It's a federal pact. And it's a covenant that the leaders make with the people, and the people make with the leaders and with God, and the leaders make with God. Federal theology, as it was called back then, was covenant theology. It was a reference to both citizens, both the ruled and rulers, saying that we had obligations to one another, and we both had obligations to God. The civil magistrate in order is not free to do just anything he wants to do. And it was this column of Protestants who began to articulate that and write about that and publish tracts about that. And so some Englishmen began to be attracted to Geneva because there was a persecution in England. Most of you think of John Knox first, and John Knox was another in this company, who later in the 1550s began to write on these themes. But there was another John who was less well known, named John Ponet. And John Ponet wrote in 1556, this is why Calvin's still alive and Ponet is in England, a short treatise on political power. And in that short treatise on political power, Ponet took these New Testament passages, he took these Old Testament passages, and he came to the grand conclusion that governors indeed had a covenantal obligation to govern the way God said they should. And in turn, the people were always to follow their governor's rule when they governed that way. But should they forfeit their legitimacy, John Ponet, John Knox, John Calvin, and others taught, then citizens had the right to overthrow and replace their rulers. In John Ponet's famous 1556 work, he made the following conclusions. One was that people could hold a ruler accountable. This is radical for the 1550s. Secondly, overthrow, even if forceful, is permitted under certain conditions. Radical for the 1550s. Thirdly, the basis for just government was transcendental as well as universal. That is, it's more than just your local customs. There should be some universal moral principles. Fourthly, government was to be limited in scope and in force. And also, there were checks and balances, and authority was diffused. dispersed to these various spheres. John Calvin then wrote his final edition of his Institutes in 1559, so we're sneaking up on some of this progress. I'll bring this historical part to a close in a few moments, but let me read you some comments from Calvin on these passages in Acts. Since I started with those, let me go back to those. And I want you to hear some of his explicit comments. John Calvin, although, again, he did not call for the overthrow of the king, he did call for the overthrow of a tyrant. And tyrant was a very important term in the 16th and 17th centuries. And a tyrant was not just an evil, mean ruler, but he was one who was exceeding the bounds of what a ruler should do. And Calvin wrote on Acts 4:19 in the year 1560 that undoubtedly Peter, when he's speaking, called tyranny the crime, if you will, that the Pharisees and the priests were committing. And when Calvin said those priests, in ordering Peter and John not to preach anymore, were tyrants, he was calling them a name that would light up with red lights if anybody was listening. Later on that same verse in Acts 4:19, but because they abused their authority, the apostles say flatly that they are not to be obeyed. Also that obedience to unlawful government of the church is contrary to God. Therefore, by what title soever men be called, yet must we hear them only upon this condition, if they lead us not away from obeying God. You see in Calvin the prioritization of the first table over the second. We must obey princes and others which are in authority, yet so that they do not rob God of His right and authority. And if we must observe such modesty in civil government, it ought to be of more force in the spiritual government of the church. Let me read you some of Calvin's comment on Acts 5:29. When this sentence takes place, there we ought rather to obey God than man. Therefore, we must obey rulers so far as the commandment of God is not broken. If a magistrate do his duty as he ought, then a man shall in vain say that he's contrary to God. So yes, I still have to obey the speed limits. Well, actually, I don't have to. What's my other alternative? Pay a lot of money. Okay? So you do have choices, by the way. I mean, we should remind our friends who are dissatisfied with any particular manifestation of government, you do have options. Now, they may not be pleasant options, but you can move to another country. I always like, and you'll start seeing it crank up, I always like seeing usually stars of the left say that they're going to leave America if a certain Republican or right-wing politician is elected. I just don't know in my lifetime if I remember that ever actually happening. But that's an option. You can go to Canada, but actually after last week, that's not going to be much better, is it? You can move to Mexico. You're free to move. So we have options. We are not oppressed. There have been people in the New Testament, and that's why Matthew 10 speaks of this, who have no options, and their only option is to flee to another city. And there are persecuted Christians who have no options, and they can't even flee. So we're very blessed in that. So be very careful that you don't try to manipulate things. Be honest with yourself and seek to be under good counsel and good submission in your church, so that you won't go astray and become cultic in that. Calvin continues in Acts 5:29, we must obey God's ministers and officers if we will obey Him. But so soon as rulers lead us astray from the obedience of God because they strive against God with sacrilegious boldness, their pride must be abated that God may be above all in authority. You see, for Calvin, there's a higher authority over your local rulers. Then he applies it in Acts 5:29 to the home. Therefore, if a father, being not content with his own estate, do essay to take from God the chief honor of a father, he's nothing else but a man. A father can forfeit his role as a father and be nothing else but a man. If a king or ruler or magistrate so becomes so lofty that he diminishes the honor and authority of God, he is but a man. We must think also of pastors. For he who goes beyond the bounds of his office is despoiled, unless he be conflated with a tyrant. We must obey those who do not serve the Lord. So the New Testament commentaries take these, they're called house codes, the commandments to fathers to love their children and children to submit, commands of husbands to love their wives, the commands of wives to submit to them and respect them, the commands of slaves to submit to their employers, and the commands of church members elsewhere to submit to the elders that God has put in your church. All of those are qualified by something very important, and that is that the leader or the ruler is behaving within bounds. He doesn't have to be a perfect leader, but he has to be operating within certain confines. He has to be on the football field, in other words, not out of the sidelines. And he has to operate as God has told him to, or he may find himself being overthrown. And the Protestant consciences arose, saying not only must we overthrow, but John Knox was a little bit fiery, more fiery than John Calvin, said we really should do it, and we should do it with armed rebellion. So there were different temperatures that were present among these reformers. Well, let me skip for the remaining time to the end and make a few comments. Let me just try to set this out this way. Oh, by the way, Theodore Beza, Teddy Beza. Theodore Beza was the most important political thinker for the West. Ready? The most important political thinker in the West. He's given no credit. You're not going to take any political sides. I want you to, you tell me. You write me, you email me, you call me, you let me know when you take a poli-sci course and you're assigned the 1574 work of Theodore Beza entitled The Due Right of Magistrates. It won't happen. I'll give you those Cardinals tickets for the ones I offered to find the Westminster Divines. Theodore Beza was sort of the point guard of the American Revolution, as I call him. He was a guy who came down, he passed the ball off, he didn't score a lot, he wasn't the leading scorer, he didn't get all the headlines, but he was essential to make the team work. Theodore Beza was Calvin's right-hand man. It would be a stretch to prove, some have tried, but I think they failed miserably, but it would be a stretch to prove that Beza and Calvin differed on any major subject. Their lives overlapped. Beza studied with Calvin. He came to Geneva. He taught. He was appointed as the first rector of Calvin's academy. He was trusted by Calvin. After he died, you did not see a spate of pamphlets in Geneva or elsewhere saying, what's happened to the Calvinistic legacy now that Beza is alive? To give you this analogy, some people my age were big fans of Ronald Reagan. And when Ronald Reagan ended his time in office, another Republican president, George Herbert Walker Bush, was elected president. And a whole lot of people began to say, Bush is no Reagan. And that was in a four-year period, a fairly short period of time. And whether that's your view or not, I just want to give that as an illustration. After Calvin dies, people don't say, Beza's no Calvin, not the contemporary. Now we have later scholars who want to insert a wedge between Calvin and other words. In fact, they really want to isolate Calvin, and they try to make Calvin to be the Nathan Bedford Forrest of Geneva, or somebody hideous, or Hitler, or someone terrible. But the truth is, Calvin had a great influence. He had a continuing impact on those who wrote political theory, of whom Theodore Beza was one of the chief. And here were the themes that began to congeal among Protestant political thought in the 1570s and 1580s. There were, several themes that came about. One was that in contrast to monarchy or pure democracy, either one, republicanism was ordained by God. These pastors and teachers began to teach that, and they said it is right and it is in God's word for people to have some say-so in their government. Secondly, the Old Testament passages provided a basis for the judicial system, complete with a review and appeal function. More on that another time. Checks and balances were designed to thwart human depravity. Those were necessary, and rulers were to be under law. Rulers next were expected to meet biblical qualifications for righteous kings or for senators, as Calvin and others said, the assistance to Moses' group were in Exodus 18. If you go back and read Calvin's commentary in Exodus 18, he actually calls those that Jethro advised to be counselors over 10 and 50 and 100 to Moses. He calls them senators, which is a stunning use of a term for the 1560s. Beza was very important. He raised these questions, and in part, he raised these questions because of the genocidal murder at the St. Bartholomew Day Massacre in 1572. That was a turning point. We lost an entire nation of Protestants in 1572. Those churches that had grown from zero to over 2,000 in that 32-year period were eradicated. They were wiped out. This was religious genocide. And the Catholic monarch turned, assassinated key Protestant leaders and killed them in the thousands, with 2,000 being killed in one day in one city, 1,000 being killed in Orléans, France, in one day, 800 at Lyon, and hundreds of others. There was a cold-blooded murder of up to 60,000 French Huguenots in a single month that forced Calvin's disciple Beza and others to go back and re-examine their tradition. And they had to ask, are we really to continue to submit to this while our brothers and sisters' blood is being shed? Is that right biblical interpretation? And they began to argue in a way that's still relevant today. If we had a young teenage girl in the home and her father ordered her to sell drugs illegally or to give her body into prostitution, what would your church tell that young teenage girl under the authority of the father? We'd say, no, no, no. He has transgressed that. He has stepped over the line. Don't do that. You must honor God, not him. And so the Protestant forefathers applied that to the state. They said, no, you don't have to just put your neck literally on the chopping block to die for your faith because of a tyrant or because of an evil king. The world changed. It's not been the same since. Listen to Tyndale's statement as I draw this to a close in the 1520s. This is the beginning of the change. Tyndale said, God has made the king in every realm judge over all, and over him there is no judge. He that judgeth the king judgeth God. And he that layeth a hand on the king layeth a hand on God. And if the subject sin, then they must be brought to the king's judgment. If the king sins, he must be reserved unto the judgment, wrath, and vengeance of God. William Tyndale, Protestant forefather, was still carrying out that medieval view of church and state, and said we have no right not only to rebel, but not even to judge a king, not even to dare speak against a monarch. The sea change came quickly. John Knox began to write, and by the spring of 1558, events increased persecution, and a number of years of turmoil and exile had pushed Knox into clearly articulating the full-blown resistance theory which he had previously laid the foundation. And the two major linchpins that changed from the time of Beza and Knox until the founding of America were these: submission is limited, and number two, representation was absolute. It was to be a representative government in every place. The development from Luther and Calvin to the new world of John Cotton and Jonathan Mayhew and Samuel Adams eliminated the presumption that submission to an evil or illegitimate ruler was obligatory. The post-Reformation Calvinists and some Catholics came on board, agreed that the law and the contract intervened between God and the monarch. These Protestant forefathers reformed the interpretation of political texts in the Scripture. And that was a first step in the shift. And they viewed themselves, though, as doing so on scriptural and ethical grounds. They viewed themselves as the successors to Peter in Acts chapter 4 and in Acts chapter 5, who courageously said, we must obey God more than men. That has so many applications in your life and mine, doesn't it? It has applications in your workplace. It has applications as you witness among fellow students and among those in your neighborhood. We must obey God over men. Thank you for listening. you want to do a Q&A?
Go ahead.
If you want to ask some questions or have some interaction, I'm happy to do that. You may want to go. Yes, sir. Dan? Yeah, I think so. And I think Knox went further than Calvin did in Calvin's lifetime. I'll have to check and see the exact dates in which Knox passed away. I can't recall, but I don't think Knox was actually alive for the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. But he was writing in the 1550s and 1560s, and he did come to Geneva, and he saw that, and he went back to Scotland with real fire. And he had seen, as you said, he had suffered that persecution. He had suffered imprisonment and saw that firsthand. So he passed away a little bit earlier than Beza. Beza continued, but Beza lived a very long life and was actually a real hero in Geneva. But they saw these oppressive measures up close. And I have to say that as Americans, we're also very comfortable. We read about things and we've been spared those kinds of agonizing. I mean, what would you do if one Sunday, Brent said you had 200 worshipers. What would you do if you went just the next Sunday and there were only 80 of you? And over half had been beheaded by the civil government. That would make an impact in life, wouldn't you? And you'd go back to the scriptures and you'd say, I want to make sure I'm on scriptural ground. We don't want to get carried away here. And that was the other excess that Calvin and others warned against. There are excesses in democracy. There are excesses in mob rule. And that's why the Calvinists found that strong middle and said, no, we always have representative leaders. We have a small group. We do have leaders. It's never a monarchy, but neither is it pure democracy. And the founders of America got that. I'm not sure all Christians see that as clearly today, because some of the Christian leaders I hear speak act as if we can just get democracy installed in some nation in the Middle East, everything will be fine. And somehow I doubt that will occur that way.
I understand that Knox believed in regicide, and by that I mean that it was an obligation certainly to kill a wicked king. And it seems like that would be the principle we get from jail. She was just a civilian.
Right.
She killed a wicked man.
Right.
And I think Knox, what I understand about Knox, he didn't believe that the lesser magistrate was to be in charge of the people that were
I'm not sure that that's exactly the at least the readings that I've done in Knox. I'm not so sure that Knox wouldn't agree with Calvin. They always said that they have to have the intermediary authorities do this because our passions get out of control. And I'm not so sure that the point from the JL murder was that citizens are called to have uprisings. Because Calvin was too strongly opposed to that in too many different venues and in too many different writings. And I'm not aware that Knox, sometimes he's character that he did go a little bit beyond Calvin, but I'm not sure that he went quite that far. Yes, sir.
You mentioned writing of Theodore Beza on political theory that you said was the most important.
The Due Right of Magistrates, 1574. The Bartholomew's Massacre was 1572, and in a short period, a couple years later, he came forth with this. And the Due Right of Magistrates sounds as if the title might be in defense of the rulers, but it also has a subtitle, a second part, and the Due Right of Citizens, Due Rights of the People, which is usually left off. You can find that, by the way, when I started doing research on this, 30 years ago, you literally could not find these tractates unless you went to a library in Geneva or in London or at Oxford. You guys can probably, I'll go out here if the internet service is good enough, and probably find it online and talk about it at dinner. not in toto, and it was done in French first, and then in Latin. And part of the problem with Beza's works is that many of them are still untranslated in English from the French, but they were all translated into Latin. Well, thanks. You've been patient. Feel free to ask any other questions. And I'm so grateful to be here. And may I say, I'll say again in the morning, don't ever underestimate the blessing you have in having a wonderful, faithful pastor. They don't grow on trees. They're not made like this anymore. And you are blessed from a 3-decade-long ministry of the Word, and your church shows it.